Hi, and welcome to Intern Ready OBGYN, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your intern year in OBGYN. My name is Dr. Lucy Brown. I'm a resident at Johns Hopkins and your host for Intern Ready OBGYN. Hi, and welcome back to Intern Ready. I'm Dr. Lucy Brown, and I'm joined by my co-resident, Dr. Emily Stock.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And what are we going to be talking about today?
We are going to be reviewing what you need to know about postmenopausal bleeding, what it is, how to work it up, and next steps for when more investigation is needing to be done. This is a topic close to my heart as a budding GYN oncologist.
All right. So to get started, what is postmenopausal bleeding?
Postmenopausal bleeding is any uterine bleeding in a menopausal patient, meaning someone who's been without menses for at least 12 months. And this is bleeding that's now unexpected. Classically, postmenopausal bleeding is concerning for endometrial cancer, and postmenopausal bleeding is cancer until proven otherwise, as bleeding after menopause is the cardinal sign of malignancy. Given this, a menopausal patient with any unanticipated bleeding does warrant evaluation to exclude cancer. Mm-hmm. If caught early, oncologic outcomes are typically favorable and typically only require surgery for treatment. Fortunately, though, most causes of postmenopausal bleeding are benign rather than cancer.
Yeah. So how often do we see postmenopausal bleeding, like in clinic?
Yeah, great question. So postmenopausal bleeding accounts for approximately 5% of office visits in this age group, affecting around 10% of patients. The incidence appears to be inversely related to the time since menopause, with the occurrence decreasing over time.
I know you mentioned malignancy as a cause. What are some other reasons?
So while the presence of cancer is the most worrisome, the differential diagnosis can really be categorized into three main buckets. The first, structural causes, the second, premalignant or cancer, and the third, other. The first category for the structural causes is the most common. These include polyps, 35% of the time, atrophy, 30% of the time, and fibroids, though much less common in this age group, occurring about 5%. That second bucket is the premalignant of cancer. Endometrial hyperplasia and cancer are the most worrisome etiologies, with hyperplasia occurring in about 2% and cancer in about 5%. And that third category is kind of a catch-all and includes proliferative or secretory endometrium 15% of the time, as well as other things like medications, radiation changes, infection, and then non-uterine bleeding causes, which are more rare. So to expand on these causes, for the first bucket, the structural causes, polyps are the most common. This is a localized overgrowth of the glands and stroma, and polyps are one of the most common causes, like I mentioned, for postmenopausal bleeding. Usually polyps are benign, but the presence of malignancy or hyperplasia, or that overgrowth of that tissue within a polyp, is higher in this age group, and therefore it does need to be worked up, which we'll talk about later. Atrophy is another one of the most common structural causes for postmenopausal bleeding. The pathophysiology of this is that low estrogen state in the menopausal state causes atrophy, not only of the vagina, but also of the endometrium. And this leads to friction, which can cause microerosions and a state of chronic inflammation, which then is prone to spotting or bleeding. And the final structural cause is the fibroids. Fibroids are the most common benign pelvic tumor, which are usually symptomatic in an earlier age patient who's menstruating still and can present with pain, bleeding, or bulk symptoms. After menopause, fibroids usually decrease in size due to the less estrogen exposure and are therefore not symptomatic in older individuals. So if bleeding does occur in someone with a known history of fibroids when they are postmenopausal, this bleeding needs to be assumed to be from pathology and not just the fibroid itself. If the fibroid is increasing in size or causing symptoms in an older individual, then that also could be a possibility of something like a uterine sarcoma, which is rare, but something that can be serious.
Great. So those are kind of all the benign reasons that a patient would have postmenopausal bleeding. What about that next category, premalignant changes in malignancy? I know that in GYN onc clinic, many of our onc attendings call postmenopausal bleeding equivalent to like the red flag.
Yeah, so that's very much true. So for endometrial cancer or carcinoma, it's the most common GYN cancer in the United States, and its prevalence is on the rise due to the overall health status of the country shifting towards a greater proportion of the population being overweight and obese. Mm-hmm. Endometrial cancer does present with postmenopausal bleeding in up to 90% of cases. So this is what you are referring to when it's that red flag. And so the cancer comes about by the symptomatic bleeding, which is what the patient presents for care for. Risk factors for cancer include increasing age, obesity, unopposed estrogen, early menarche, late menopause, mm-hmm. nulliparity, history of PCOS or type 2 diabetes, the use of tamoxifen, or if they're found to have atypical glandular cells on like cervical cancer screening, or if they have another like estrogen secreting tumor. Additionally, if a patient has a known hereditary cancer syndrome, like Lynch syndrome, which is the hereditary non-polypopous colorectal cancer, or something called Cowden syndrome, or other family history of like breast, ovarian, or colon cancer, this also increases a patient's risk for endometrial cancer.
And then what are some pre-malignant changes?
So these pre-malignant changes include the endometrial hyperplasia, either with or without atypia, meaning the glands are kind of overgrowing what they usually are when you look at it under the microscope. And this hyperplasia can progress to or coexist with cancer in up to 30 to 50% of the cases. And there's a great article from ACOG on the management of this, which is included in the resources that'll be at the end of this episode.
We'll definitely include those resources below. Now, you mentioned a third category, other. What is included in that?
For that other category of postmenopausal bleeding, this includes the presence of proliferative or secretory endometrium, which is distinct from the hyperplasia that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. The presence of this suggests exposure to estrogen, such as by excess adipose tissue or an estrogen-producing tumor, or the use of exogenous estrogens, as in hormone replacement therapy. Medications like HRT can be another cause and include anticoagulants, antiplatelets, glucocorticoids, antibiotics, SSRIs, alcohol, and the use of supplements like vitamin E, garlic, and ginkgo have all been shown to cause uterine bleeding. And then you have the less common category or less common causes also included in that other category. And this would be like prior radiation changes, if you have an infection or non-uterine bleedings from adjacent organs, such as like a foreign body reaction, or if you have trauma or injury to the lower genital tract, either from sexual intercourse or assault. But overall, the key takeaway is that postmenopausal bleeding usually is from benign conditions like polyps or atrophy, but given the concern for cancer, a prompt and thorough evaluation is needed to be able to either diagnose or exclude cancer as your first priority. And then your second kind of goal or priority would be to exclude other processes that could be contributing to this.
So let's go back to our patient sitting with us in clinic with postmenopausal bleeding. I'm imagining that we should begin with a thorough history and physical.
That is absolutely correct. So starting with your good H&P is number one. When thinking about gathering a patient's history for this presenting complaint, the purpose is to distinguish between uterine and other causes for the postmenopausal bleeding. So things you want to think about to ask your patient sitting in front of you would be, when did the bleeding start? What is the nature of the bleeding? Kind of how long has it been going on? How much? How often? Anything that precipitates it? Does it come on by intercourse or have you had recent trauma? Do you have other associated symptoms like pain, abnormal discharge, vaginal dryness or soreness? Are you having bloating or early satiety and changes in appetite or bowel bladder habits? Any history of obesity or type 2 diabetes or PCOS? And then what medications are you on? Any anticoagulants, any hormone replacement, history of tamoxifen use, and what herbal or dietary supplements are you currently using? And importantly, it is important to ask about any personal or family history of like endometrial, breast, or colon cancer. And the answers to these questions can really help point you towards your possible etiologies for the bleeding and help establish your early working diagnosis or working differential diagnosis. For example, if a patient has pain with intercourse so along with vaginal dryness, atrophy could be the cause. Mm-hmm. If a patient has a history of obesity and type 2 diabetes with prior irregular periods before they went through menopause or use of tamoxifen, these point more towards endometrial cancer as these are all risk factors for it. It is also worth noting that endometrial cancer can present with pain. If the uterine bleeding is getting trapped by some cervical stenosis, that's preventing the release of blood from the cavity, and the blood is instead pooling inside of the uterus.
All right. So now moving towards the physical exam, what are you looking for?
So your physical exam is important. It makes sure you want to assess the BMI of the patient, perform an abdominal, pelvic, and a skin exam to look for any signs of trauma. In your abdominal exam, evaluate for any masses, pain, prior incisions. And then when you do your pelvic exam, you want to do both a speculum as well as a bimanual internal exam to help determine the site of bleeding. Is it from the uterus or from the lower genital tract or maybe from another source? On your speculum exam, it's important to assess for any concerning lesions, any lacerations or foreign bodies in the vulva, the vagina, or the cervix. And then at this part of the exam, if the patient is due for any cervical cancer screening, it's important to do that as well, as you have to evaluate the cervix in someone who's presenting with bleeding because it can be difficult to distinguish if it's coming from the uterus or the endocervical canal. And then if any noted lesions on your cervical exam should be biopsied, regardless if that cytology from the pap smear is normal. On your bimanual internal exam, it's important to feel for the size and the contour of the uterus and assess for any tenderness or masses in the uterus and the annexal structures. And having a normal pelvic exam usually can exclude any lower genital tract etiology as the source for the postmenopausal bleeding.
And that's really good advice to always look up your patient's pap history because they might be super behind on their pap smears and then you can get another kind of screening test out of the way. And then what, after your physical exam, what comes next?
So the next step is evaluating the endometrium once you presume that the bleeding is coming from the uterus. And you really have two options to start with. Option number one would be to complete a transvaginal ultrasound. And option two would be to start with endometrial sampling. For that option number one with the ultrasound, the goal is to obtain a reliable measurement of the thickness of the endometrium, which is done by measuring it in the perpendicular longitudinal plane to measure the distance between those echogenic borders when you actually look at the images yourself. And this is usually the thickest portion. This distance represents the endometrial stripe, and a normal measurement is 4 millimeters or less in a postmenopausal patient. If that stripe is not thin, meaning not less than 4 millimeters in a postmenopausal patient with bleeding, then further evaluation is necessary as a stripe more than 4 millimeters is abnormal. Additionally, if you see any fluid or another abnormality that's identified on that ultrasound, these findings are also abnormal and do need further evaluation. And when interpreting the thickness of the stripe, the post-test probability of cancer is 2.5% if the stripe is less than 5. And that post-test probability of cancer is 8% when it is more than 5. And the sensitivity and specificity of this test is overall very good.
You mentioned the second option is to go ahead and just start with that endometrial sampling or endometrial biopsy. What is that and how do we do that?
Sure. So for sampling, this is obtaining a tissue biopsy of the endometrium to look at it under the microscope for a histologic evaluation. And there's really two options for how you want to collect this tissue. The first one is performing an endometrial biopsy. And the second option is to go to the OR for a minor procedure, classically a hysteroscopy DNC, which we'll get into. For that first option, for the endometrial biopsy, this is an in-office procedure that takes a few minutes usually. You have to use a speculum exam to visualize the cervix, and after doing that, you pass a thin, flexible tube called a pipelle through the cervix into the uterus, and you collect a small sample of that tissue, kind of using a suction or a scraping motion. This tissue sample is then sent to the pathologist for review under the microscope. And it's really important when you're doing this procedure to tell the patient that they could experience some mild cramping or discomfort, which would be normal. And it's also normal to have some spotting or light bleeding afterwards. This pain or discomfort can usually be managed with oral pain relievers like NSAIDs or acetaminophen. Endometrial biopsies are generally safe. Potential complications could include bleeding, infection, and in rare cases, uterine perforation or poking a little hole through the uterus. Contraindications to performing this biopsy would be absolute if they're pregnant, which usually is not applicable for our postmenopausal patient. And the relative contraindications are any cervical stenosis, coagulopathy, obstructing cervical lesions, or any anticipated difficulties performing an in-office procedure, such as body habitus, prolapse, anxiety, or if there is an active ongoing infection somewhere in the pelvic structures. That second method that I had mentioned, the hysteroscopy, that DNC or dilation and curettage, is a minor OR procedure that involves dilating the cervix, the D part, to allow for passage of cervical instruments, the curette, the C part, into the uterus to take scrapings of that uterine lining. This is usually done using a hysteroscope or a camera that also goes into the uterus, rather than doing it blindly, as we would say, without visualization, just due to the higher accuracy and the overall lower complication rates. The benefits of doing a DNC for sampling include a more thorough and reliable sampling as compared to the biopsy, since you are able to sample the entire cavity for improved detection of any focal disease. That biopsy has a higher rate of inadequate sampling and can miss focal pathology because it usually only samples roughly 5 to 15%. Other benefits to perform the hysteroscopy DNC would be that you're able to visualize the cavity and take a visual documentation of any pathology that could be causing the bleeding. And then you can also perform any concurrent procedures, such as if you do see a polyp or a submucosal fibroid, you can remove it at that time. Going to the OR also enables you to troubleshoot any cervical stenosis or another possible reason why you were unable to do the biopsy successfully in the clinic. And usually patients have improved tolerance because you do have that anesthesia on board. Downsides to going to the OR do include those things associated with going to the OR, such as increased time, expense, and risks associated with surgery and anesthesia, as well as like the usual risks of bleeding, infection, and uterine perforation.
Okay, so our biopsy is complete. We've sent it off. What does that follow-up look like?
So follow-up is dependent on what the tissue biopsy shows. There are standard guidelines for how to manage what the biopsy is, and these specifics are outside of the scope of this discussion. But really, in a nutshell, if the tissue sample is sufficient, meaning you had enough tissue, and the pathology is benign, then these patients can be expectantly managed, meaning monitored for any recurrence of bleeding, which would then warrant reinvestigation, usually with repeat sampling. If a structural lesion is identified, like a polyp or a fibroid, then removal is recommended, usually with a minor surgical procedure, the hysteroscopy DNC that we were talking about before, which does allow removal of that structure as well as more thorough sampling. If hyperplasia is identified on the biopsy, then further sampling is usually indicated, as concurrent endometrial cancer is found in up to 40% of these patients on their final pathology from their hysterectomy specimen. And the risk of malignancy increases when hyperplasia is decided to be managed expectantly. Therefore, these patients do need follow-up.
So what do you do if you find or are concerned for cancer?
If the biopsy specimen reveals cancer or high concern for it, such as concerning hyperplasia, then referral to a GYN oncologist, the specialist to deal with the GYN organ cancers, is indicated. And definitive management can include proceeding with a hysterectomy as well as removal of both fallopian tubes, ovaries, and sampling the lymph nodes to complete surgical staging, which is the standard of care for endometrial cancer.
I will be sure to send all my patients to you, future oncologist Dr. Stock. So I'll try to summarize everything that Emily just taught us about. So postmenopausal bleeding is any uterine or vaginal bleeding in a menopausal patient. Classically, this bleeding is concerning for endometrial cancer, and it's cancer essentially until proven otherwise, as bleeding after menopause is the cardinal sign of malignancy. It's that red flag. This is a GYN complaint that always warrants evaluation and workup. Although endometrial cancer is the most worrisome cause, the differential diagnosis can be categorized into three main buckets. One, structural etiology. Two, premalignant or malignancy, and three, other. Risk factors for malignancy include increasing age, obesity, unopposed estrogen, early menarche, late menopause, nulliparity, PCOS, type 2 diabetes, tamoxifen use, atypical glandular cells on screening cervical cytology. So if you get that back on your pap smear, definitely look into that. Estrogen secreting tumors, Lynch syndrome or other hereditary syndromes, and a family history of endometrial, ovarian, breast, or colon cancer. Endometrial cancer is the most common type of gynecologic cancer in the United States, and rates are expected to rise in the upcoming years due to rising rates of obesity. Workup for postmenopausal bleeding include collecting a thorough patient history and performing a physical exam. Then, after you've done your physical exam, you want to evaluate the endometrium with ultrasound imaging to assess the thickness of that endometrial stripe. A normal endometrial stripe in a postmenopausal patient is less than 4 millimeters, and anything greater than that warrants sampling. For sampling, it can either be done by endometrial biopsy in the office or a DNC in the OR. You can also do a hysteroscopy in the office, but typically we'll do it in the OR. And then follow-up for the sampling depends on the tissue diagnosis. So if it's sufficient and reveals benign findings like just atrophy, then expected management with follow-up is needed, or if bleeding recurs. If a structural lesion like a polyp or a fibroid is identified, then this should be removed. And then if hyperplasia or malignancy is identified, then referral to a GYN oncologist like Dr. Stock is indicated. If the tissue sample is insufficient, which does happen, unfortunately, especially if bleeding continues, then repeat sampling is absolutely needed, and usually with a hysteroscopy DNC rather than an endometrial biopsy to improve sampling success.
Thanks for listening to Intern Ready OBGYN. We hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below, rate the podcast, leave a review, or suggest a new episode.